Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Blueprint. Today, I've got a guest that I want to dig in as deep as he'll actually let us. It is Dan Nicholson. He's an author. He's the founder of The Ninth Degree, which is an award-winning accounting and financial consulting firm. And this guy, he does so much. There's the podcast, which is the Unconventional Wealth Podcast. He's had small businesses like Certainty U and Certainty News, consulting with PBS, all the stuff, man. I love it. And you're a man after my own heart with the lifelong serial entrepreneur. That's like right up my alley. I want to start at the beginning though, because there's so much information on and expectation around CPAs. And how they operate and what they are and what they do and my experience with CPAs. You're unconventional. We've seen your designations. What caused the shift? That's like kind of there's always that light bulb moment, because I'm assuming here, and then fill me in. I'm sure you were in the grind, like trying to build a regular run-of-the-mill CPA firm, and you realized that you had the ability to serve at a higher level. I'm assuming. Fill us in. And Dan, welcome.
I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you, Steve. And what I like to tell people as some pre-framing is that I consider myself to be an accidental accountant. And for any of you that know about what it takes to become a CPA, it sort of doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because it requires 5 years worth of education and passing an exam that has a 12% first time pass rate. So it's not accidental in the sense that I like tripped and woke up with a accounting degree in that sense. But I didn't really set out to be a CPA. I had the entrepreneurial spirit as a kid, and I went off to business school just thinking I wanted to get the best education to position myself to be entrepreneurial. And a weird thing happened at the end of my freshman year. And still doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me still, but UPS, the big shipping company, hired me as a part-time finance supervisor. So I was managing a team of about 20 auditors, all of which were significantly older than me, auditing shippers for compliance. And I was reporting to the regional finance director and controller. And so got this crazy experience at 19 until I had that job for a couple of years while I was in college. And they started kind of pitching me on the idea of switching to either a finance or accounting degree. And around the same time, the university I was going to took me out to lunch and recruited me to the accounting department as well. And they showed me all this data about how there were more Fortune 500 CEOs with accounting degrees at the time and all these other cool things that you could do with the degree. And also, if you've ever gone to business school, you know that it's like the most masochistic of the undergraduate degrees. It's like the students that are in the dark lit corners when you get there in the morning and that are still there when you leave are usually the accounting majors.
100%.
And that sort of resonated with my masochistic personality. So got that accounting degree. And then at the end of my senior year, I was nominated by the university for a fellowship at the board that writes all the accounting standards here in the US. So people have heard of GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. There are this board on the publicly traded side and the governmental side. Ended up getting that fellowship, helping write an accounting standard. And that pretty much solidified me down this path. It's like the date myself, but on Seinfeld, it's the episode where he gets the smell in his car that he can't get out. And he like keys in and the window's down. And even someone who like car thief gets in and is like, this smells bad and leaves. That's just sort of like you get the stink of the CPA helping write a standard that it sort of stayed with me. And so I kept changing jobs, and ultimately I realized 15 years ago that I was the problem, and that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I realized there was an opportunity to do something different in the CPA space. So I actually started as unconventional slightly before I started the firm, but from the beginning, we've tried to do things differently in as many ways as possible.
Yeah. Changing jobs because you didn't feel like you were serving, didn't feel like you were fulfilled, or what did that look like? Was that part of the search, part of the journey?
Yeah, I think I had not enough self-awareness to adequately identify the root problems at the time. When I left the board, I went to Deloitte, which is the largest CPA firm in the world. And I had like Microsoft as a client, for example. And they said, "Hey, Dan, we used to have three people in this role, IT audit, financial audit, et cetera. We think you could just handle all of that." So I was working a bunch of hours. So the first thing was like this, and I think it got ranked number, they stack rank you. And so I think I got ranked number one or number two in my class each year that I was there. And they're like, "Your reward is that you get a raise that's 1% more than the person who was like at the bottom of your class." And we have all these great opportunities for you, which just meant you were like working the weekend or traveling to some place you didn't want to travel to. So first it was just easy to go like, "This sucks. I'm working too much. Not really enjoying my life." And then I moved to some internal roles and in a company getting ready to go public, strategic finance role. And each time it was like, "The job isn't a fit. I think I want to try something else." So sort of blaming the job and blaming management a little bit. And ultimately, it just became apparent that I wanted an external scorecard and to prove that I could do it on my own. It wasn't about the work itself, the nature of the work. It was about what I wanted as a person for sort of my life's mission.
Nice. Thanks for the share, man. That's cool.
Yeah.
So how did, what came first? Like, as far as, you know, the amount of things that you've done, the list is long, you know, nth degree, certainty. How did that unfold and what did that look like? And what I'm really after is the why, you know, is there, what creates the unconventional portion?
Unconventional first, the whole idea of being unconventional started when I was back at the accounting board and I was single living in Norwalk, Connecticut, which if you're not familiar, it's in Fairfield County, just outside of New York City, super, super wealthy. I think at the time it was the second wealthiest county in the US. I'm 22, 23, like I said, single, and I'm helping write an accounting standard. And there's not very many single 22 to 23 year old girls in this specific area. It's not exactly a hotbed for young people. So this is early 2000s. I'm going out, you know, the way you used to have to do this, you go out to some bars and things. People are like, "So what do you do?" They're like, "Let me briefly describe to you how I'm the most boring person in this entire bar. I am a CPA who's not only that, but I'm helping write an accounting standard." And you hear this like screeching halt where someone's like, "Okay, cool. You are the most boring person in here." You know, next. So I kind of started to realize that I needed to present myself differently. So I started calling myself first just a business person, because I thought it was funny when people were like, "Business person? What is that?" It's like, at least I get a chance to have a conversation. And then I started calling myself a unconventional accountant. And the same thing happened then when I started my firm. I would go to these different networking events. And I'm in the Seattle area at this point. We got Amazon that's in its early stages. Got all these different tech companies and people are out mingling and the same things. Like, "What do you do?" "Oh, I run a CPA firm." And it was like the same reaction I had when I was trying to date in my early 20s. We're like, "Okay, yeah, you're the most boring person in this room." So I started calling myself unconventional accountant. And it's it's a contradiction. So accounting is about conventions, and I'm saying I'm saying I'm an unconventional convention. It's like people wanted to at least know what that meant. So then I had to figure out what it meant. So like, first, how can I get a conversation going? Now that I have a conversation going, what does that actually mean? And so it was an iteration that sort of led with, we evolved into accountants are like archaeologists. They just want to dig up the past. They're focused on the past. We're going to help you build the future.
Yeah.
And so there was that kind of pivot. And then like, okay, well, how do we actually do that? And over the next several years, 7 or 8 years, I realized that I actually had to unlearn a lot of what I learned in business school to be able to serve small to medium-sized companies. So there were a bunch of kind of aha moments along the way of realizing what I thought I knew was not going to work, that then culminated in creating a methodology for how we would serve these clients that led to writing a book and led to starting CertainToYou and some other businesses that are kind of an offshoot of that, the research and principles and philosophies that I developed, just trying to serve clients in a different way.
Yeah. I think unless you've experienced it, and I'll share my experience, until I found a CPA that had dealt with a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of fringe businesses, man, it was just a cattle call. And I was acutely aware that they were more worried about compliance and their license and their hourly wage than what they could actually do for me. And like kind of speaking into what you're saying, just looking at the past and never even encouraging pre-planning and really looking into the future so that we could do better the next year. And then just history repeats itself until you, the pain point hits to where you're like, I can't do this anymore. And I'm sure, you know that and have felt that. And, you know, my experience in our research so far is that you're so far from that I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And there's a couple of kind of quotes and things that I heard over the years that really helped solidify some of our thinking. One is from this guy, Chip Conley, and he has this book of these different equations on how to articulate thoughts and experiences that you're having. And he says, anxiety equals uncertainty times powerlessness. So not plus, times. I remember hearing that because it's like this moment where everything kind of came together. I had just gone through a period where I was learning a lot about my own anxiety, and I had a therapist who helped me understand kind of the difference between depression and anxiety. And he's like, hey, anxiety is really this future focused thing. So then I hear So anxiety is future focused. And then I heard from this guy who runs a pretty large wealth management company, said, well, the essential question that our clients are really asking us is, am I going to be okay? Am I going to run out of money? It's like, it's not necessarily about asset allocation or tax strategies, or it's about, am I going to be okay? In other words, can I live the life that I want? And so I started thinking about that as this overlap. That's a really future focused. That's an anxiety. It's future focused. And so in hearing that equation, stuff started to come together where, okay, well, financial anxiety, that's what I really help people with, equals financial uncertainty times financial powerlessness. Now you could add in marketing or anything you want into that. And so, well, how can we give our clients less financial anxiety? Because they're wondering, am I going to be okay? But we need to give them more financial certainty and give them more power over their finances so they don't have financial powerlessness. And then sort of start pulling at that string of how do we give them more financial certainty and more financial power? And that was sort of the genesis of a lot of what I've created over the last 8 years.
Yes. That's it. It's so true that a lot of times your clients are just looking for the two options. Do I turn left here or do I turn right? And don't just tell me what to do. Give me the lay of the land and the narrative, you know, a year out, 5 year out, 10 years out, which brings me to the question as far as what's that conversation look like? Like when you're onboarding, you get to, I'm assuming, have a much bigger conversation with your clients, right?
We do. Yeah. We have a philosophy. It's sort of what I call an operating system of how we're going to serve clients. And what I ask our clients to do is to unlearn, just like I had to, some of the things that they believed about what it would take to be quote unquote wealthy. And it's no secret that everyone wants to be wealthy as fast as possible. So I'm not telling people to unlearn that you want to get there as fast as possible. But where we differentiate on our orientation or operating system is that we want to get there with the least amount of effort, the least amount of risk, and the least amount of obligation. And when I tell people, hey, can I help you live the life that you want, fund what we call your solvable problem, your unique definition of wealth, we want to do that in the as fast as possible, but we want to do it in the least amount of effort, least amount of risk, least amount of obligation. They go, that sounds great. But then they have to start realizing, but I don't do, that's not how I operate currently. I currently operate by the most amount of effort and I'm redlining on risk. So all I have is obligation. So it's like, that's what they want. But to get there is like, I have to rewire and reapproach how I'm doing a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Now you touched on, I want to dig into it a little bit, if you'll let me. Example, you know, you've got a 2-year-old to a 5-year-old company coming to you, you know, entrepreneur or whatever the industry is, doesn't really matter. There's always those mistakes that you see, right? So dive into the myths and legends of what people think as opposed to what's real. Cause I'm assuming there's always 2-3 things that you're like, okay, let's address these because I know they're there. Cause that, you know, it's a new company, whatever the case may be.
So I sort of start with the overarching philosophy to how we're going to accomplish this. In the finance world, one of the sayings, consistency over accuracy. Not because we don't want things to be accurate, it's just that we need to be consistent in what, how we record transactions, how we make decisions. If you're recording transactions in a bunch of different random ways, you can't compare results. If you're solving the same problem 5 different ways, can't really compare results. If your investment approach in one area or one investment is then different than the next one, can't really compare and reconcile. So consistency over accuracy. So when I ask people, that business owner, and they could be 2 to 5 years in, or they could be 15 years in, what are your rules around money? Steve, what do you think they tell me?
As far as, I think the biggest rule I think they're going to say is that, I don't know, you know, I see so many people that are not worry about the risk because they're just all in. But the norm I would think would be keep it in the black.
Yeah. So what they say is maybe a version of that. I go, what are your rules around money? They say have as much of it as possible.
that's actually even better.
Have as much as possible. And you're like, that's cool. I'm a dad. I like dad jokes. That's kind of a dad joke, but it's not, it's an outcome. It's not a rule. So then you push out that a little bit more. And what they'll usually say is there's 5 different wealth types. And if anyone wants to do this, they can go to wealthtype.com and take a free assessment. But there's hustlers, gamblers, optimizers, savers, and outsourcers. Now, most entrepreneurs fall into the hustler and gambler area. So if they're a hustler, they say, oh, my rule is just all in at all times. I'm just, if I'm not getting my results, I work 10 times harder. Gamblers like, oh, I bet in the farm. If you're not burning the boats, then you're not winning. Right? It's like, okay, again, these are not rules. These are kind of like, if you were trying to put in together an investment thesis document, you'd be like, and to present that to potential investors, they would have a panic attack. They're like, so our investment process is at maximum effort and maximum risk. I'm going to go ahead and pass on that because it sounds like I'm going to lose a bunch of money on this. So they don't have any rules or principles around how they're making financial decisions. And they don't basically have an investment thesis. Even though a business is typically your largest investment, the data says that small business owners have 85% of their net worth on average tied up in their business. So they're betting hard on that. Only 2% of them know the value of the business. That's a whole other problem. They're sort of like putting a bunch of money into a 401k, but they can never see the statement balance because they don't know how much the company is worth. But they have no rules that they can consistently follow. And they have not turned what their definition of wealth is into what I call a solvable problem. So they've done the vision board. I've done a vision board before. Have you done a vision board before, Steve?
I have. That's extremely helpful.
You get a ton of dopamine. You feel awesome. You're going to have a six pack by the end of the week. You're going to have a second home and a Ferrari and all that. Most people lose momentum after 2 to 3 weeks because they go from a lot of chaos, not really having any idea of what they want out of their life, to a very rigid model. They're like, okay, I put this on a big sheet of paper. I got to get up earlier. I got to charge harder. It caused them to do a bunch of effort, but they don't actually know what each of those goals cost. They don't know what the timeline is to fund each of those goals. They don't know what their current resources are. So it's kind of like, I want to go to Disneyland, but I'm not going to tell Google Maps when I want to arrive, if I'm going to drive or fly, where my current location is, or like, you just get in the car, you just drive. I bet if I just drive long enough, I'm going to get to Disneyland. But you might have actually gone in the wrong direction, 10,000 miles or 3,000 miles away from Disneyland. And then you're like, did I get any closer? Or for most entrepreneurs, what you did is you drove in a circle for 5 years.
Well, we have a saying in our household, and it's hit this interview process a couple times, that if you don't know where you're going, it's pretty hard to get there.
That's exactly true. So we got to get clear on the outcomes that we want, or what I call solvable problem. We got to get some rules in place and principles about how we're going to make decisions. For our clients, we give them a document. This the 15 money rules. They're fill in the blank for some of them. And an example might be, I'm going to as a money rule that I have on the sheet is, I'll characterize money coming in, so revenue coming in, as either recurring or a windfall. So recurring is expected. Windfall is the one time. The reason why I do that is I have another rule, which is windfalls are only going to be used on one-time expenses, or I'm going to put it as a cash reserve. Recurring, I can use for recurring expenses. Now, why is that important? Well, let's go back to all the money, free money that was printed during the COVID times. I have a bunch of clients who came to me who treated all that windfall money, it's one time, PPP, EIDL, that's a loan, ERTC, those credits, they treated it like it was new found ongoing money. So they upscaled their lifestyle. They brought on more employees. They bought a bigger house, moved their kids to private school, got a second house, but they didn't actually grow their recurring revenue. So I've seen business owners, small business owners, being in a worse financial position after the fact, because now their burn rate is so much higher just to be in the same place. And they could have prevented that by sort of just labeling simply, this is windfall money. I could only use that for one-time expenditures or savings. This is what's actual recurring. Okay, I can use that to take on new expenses that will be ongoing.
Yes. So funny you say that. I have multiple clients that got larger than they should have, let's say, PPP loans.
Uh-huh.
And across the board, there's regret that they all should have put it into an asset that was, you know, pick your poison, safer, a higher level of arbitrage, like whatever the case is. That easy money, whether it be because it was too easy, too much, whatever the case may be, there's regret across there. And to your point, there was no rules, so there was no consistency. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see you speak about it, and immediately I see examples of people that if they would have had those rules in place, if they would have had even the goal in place, that they would have had a way better outcome.
Yeah, and what I have learned in terms of working with the ultra high net worth, especially earlier in my career, is it's what they do really well is identify what I call asymmetric opportunities or asymmetric bets, where there's way more upside than downside. And so what they think about risk, they're thinking about it with a totally different framework than the small business owner. The small business owner will risk all the PPP money that came in to try to get another 10% per year out of their business. That's not what the ultra high net worth are going to do. They'll make a bet that has a 10% probability of success, but if it works out, it has a 100x return. Much different sort of framework. And so they're still taking risk, but the relative reward is significantly higher, and they're cutting all the downside. Right. So they're taking, because if you take all the downside off the table, all you're left with is upside.
Yeah.
That's what I learned. So the accounting standard I worked on was the derivatives and hedge accounting standard. And when I worked at Deloitte, I mostly worked in the capital markets derivative space. And that's what I really saw was, let's eliminate all the downside. Then we only have upside. And when we make a bet, we're only going to allocate resources where there's a significant return. Why? Because resources are scarce. If I make a bet in one area and tie up the time, money, energy, et cetera, into that, I've removed an infinite number of other things I could have been doing. It's hard to think in terms of infinite, but more practically, I put money in one investment that gets me a 10% return. Tie up a bunch of time. There were five others that maybe had 20, 30, 100x potential return. I can no longer participate in those.
Right.
Because the money is tied up. And that's what people are missing, is they're putting too much effort in, taking too much risk. And so they completely miss out on the asymmetric opportunities because they're too busy and their money's tied up in things that aren't going to give them a large enough return. And then they find themselves driving around in a circle.
Yeah. There's something you said that I learned that became a really great tool, is just the risk reward ratio. Mm-hmm. And really diving into it and understand, like, put it on paper and really hold yourself accountable. Like, especially entrepreneurs seem like they are the ultimate optimists, right? And so I think they miss some risk or misallocate how much risk there actually could be, right?
100%. Yep. First off, what comes to mind and what you just shared is that there's a tendency for not just entrepreneurs, just say people in general, to think about things in terms of only one currency, money. But as you very well know, there's several other currencies: time, your identity, your energy, your reputation. We could give other examples,
right?
And so we either just think about things in terms of money, or sometimes we think about things in terms of time, but we don't get the currency correct that we actually care about. So you can't solve the problem if you didn't properly characterize it from the beginning. Let me give you a practical example. I'm going back to COVID times. I'm sure you had these conversations in abundance pre-COVID, where you'd ask your clients, what is your number one priority? And if they had kids, they say, spend more time with my kids. Universally, unless they're like, you know, in certain area, certain age range when they're like preteen or teenager, where maybe they weren't so much like, I need more time with my kids. But in general, I want more time with my kids. COVID happens. We are forced to have more time with our kids. What did everyone say? Can we get these kids back to school? I can't stand to have and them in my house so much.
Yeah.
And how quickly did that happen? I think we can measure it in days, not necessarily, well, not months. Within days or weeks, we're like, these kids are driving me nuts. Right. So what was the actual currency that people wanted? It wasn't more time with their kids. I think it was, I want more energy. I want to be more present when I'm around my family, which is a challenge I think many entrepreneurs struggle with, is being present, because you're always thinking about the next problem or the next issue. Solving for energy and being more present is a much different problem to solve for than time. Because if you need more energy when you get home at the end of the day, you might need different clients. You might need different processes at work. You might need a different schedule. You might need to say no to some new opportunities because you're going to have to travel more, right? So that's solving for a much different problem. So the first thing is lack of sort of clarity around what you're actually solving for, that I think entrepreneurs need to get a clear picture on.
Yeah. You just touched on something. That's one of the first things we do as well in our course, is that we show that money is just stored time and energy. Mm-hmm. And now that you stated that, I kind of want to go back in there and get a little deeper, because there is, what percent time, what percent energy, because there's variable change there too, right? Depending on, like, you can put a lot of time into something or a lot of energy. It's not like it's a 50-50 split. So I think creating awareness around that is incredibly useful, so that you know, like, what you're speaking into is what part of that is important to you, but just having the awareness that as far as where your assets are and what you're putting, you know, your time and your energy assets.
Yeah, 100%. I'm looking over at my one of the rules, and what I tell small business owners or my clients is, when they're, for example, thinking about interest rates, but it's not just interest rates, it could be any investment they're making, to impute or add in what I call the cost of cognitive burden. This is one of those things I did not learn in business school. You can't Google the cost of cognitive burden in finance, because what business school teaches you is to get a job at a Fortune 500 company. And the things you learn in a finance class or accounting class don't really work in a small business, because Fortune 500 companies have to maximize shareholder value. Closely held small businesses need to optimize towards what their owners want, the life that they want. So optimizing and maximizing are totally different frameworks. Maximizing, the cool budgets and forecasts and analysis that you do, that's developed by the accounting and finance department, who also update those reports and make decisions off of it. Small business owner doesn't have that team. They have the time and energy to look at those reports, and then the mental toll that it takes to have to think about it, because they don't have a team that's doing that reporting back. So there's a cost and energy, and it's different. So my mom is very debt adverse. She takes on something that has a bunch of debt. It's like, she's thinking about that every day. It's like, she's losing sleep. Me, on the other hand, it's like, what's the math say? I'm gonna make a math-based decision. So there's a different cost of cognitive burden relative to that person and their style and their preferences and mindset, all of those things.
Yeah. Do you get into that as far as, or get into it deeper, I should say, as far as the making emotional decisions compared to just basing it on the numbers and the facts, or how to intermingle those to get what you want?
Yeah, we do. I have what I call the four commandments of financial certainty. And they're these sort of, statements that I ask people to enroll in. One is, for example, we bias closer over more. What does that mean? More is just our default. We need more clients, more revenue. It's maximizing. Closer is, what do I really want? What am I really trying to achieve? And I tell people, if you're uncertain, because we vote with our money. So when we're uncertain, it's probably because you're going after the thing you don't really want. So it's a time to pause and reflect and go for a walk. So anytime you're not certain about something, pause, sleep on it, go for a walk, go back to your solvable problem. What do I really want? So we kind of take them through these different thoughts and principles to help navigate between all the different emotions that we face.
Yeah. And then relying on the rules for consistency, correct?
That's right. Yep. Yep. So yes. Another example.
It's such a good model.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'll give you another practical example. And this is how my simplistic brain works sometimes, which is someone will say on my team or client, hey, should I make this, should we hire this agency? And then I sort of go like, I deduce it down to like, is a thing worth doing? Like at the most basic level, how do I know if a thing is worth doing? At first, when I ask myself, like in general, how do I decide if a thing is worth doing? Like, I don't really know. I guess how I feel at the time or what the spreadsheet says, or that's not really a consistent way of processing things. So I create this thing called the four lenses. And it's basically these four different buckets that I process an issue through. And it's business specific, but you could rename these categories to be personal specific or industry specific if you wanted. One is, will it generate revenue? If so, how much? Two, will it result in a cost savings? If so, how much? Three, will it save time now or in the future? So how much? And then four, is it a forcing function? Meaning, is it going to cause me to do something I planned on doing anyways? That's just a yes or no. And so I just create this running list of ideas and things I'm considering doing. And a lot of times, I don't know if it's going to create revenue. I don't know if it's going to create savings, because I'm not a Fortune 500 company. We don't have the data. We don't have what we call preponderance of data. So it's a zero. Biggest risk that we do to ourselves when we're not making an asymmetric bet is we just estimate without any data. Like, oh, it's going to be $1 million. So that's clearly what I was just like, no data.
It's got to be a million.
Got to be, yeah. So my rule is no data, it's a zero. And so what happens is you have a running list and you can sort by what has the highest impact. And you may see the thing that has the most amount of revenue, time savings, cost savings, and it's a forcing function. But you may still have a thing on the list that you're like, I still want to do this, even though it's a zero on revenue, it's a zero on, I think that it will be something. So one of our other principles that I write about in my book as well is called taking a micro step. And it's basically an idea of making things more risk adjusted. And the question is, what is the smallest thing you can do to get a piece of data? So what's the smallest action with the least amount of risk that I can get some data? And before I do that, what is the rule that I'm going to set in advance of what the data needs to be for me to proceed to the next step? Because I know we're all biased. We're all subject to ownership bias. So we value our house more than our neighbors. That makes sense. But we also value our own ideas more than anyone else's ideas. They're ours. We own them. So we're going to get attached the more steps we take to wanting to do this. So what's the smallest step? What's a rule I'm going to set in advance? So this is what I did with so I decided I wanted to write a book, but I thought, well, the risk here is there's a good chance no one's going to read it. I'm going to make negative dollars on it. It's going to save me no time, but I guess it would be a forcing function because it would cause me to do something I wanted to do anyways, which is get documentation for my team around sort of my thinking and operating system. So, well, what is the smallest step I can take? Well, let me do a Facebook post and an email and ask people, hey, if I were to write this book, here's the broad strokes of it. Would you buy a copy? And in advance, I said, I need at least 100 people to say yes. If I don't get at least 100 people, then I'm going to pause it. I may come back to it later. I'm going to pause it. So I got at least 100 people. And I said, okay, well, the next small step is I'm going to have people pre-order, because I know people vote with their money. And someone might say, oh, yeah, yeah, that sounds, yeah, Steve, I'd love to buy your book. And you're like, okay, well, here's a checkout link. Never hear from them. Not your book, but you know, what, you get the example. I'm not trying to pick on you. And so then I set another rule, which was, okay, I need 100 people to check out. By the end of it, I pre-sold 5,000 copies, so I was stuck doing the book at that point. But it sort of was this micro step of validating. And then once I had sold pre-sold 5,000 copies, it's like, well, I'm more past the rule that I had, and I know I'm going to get more reach than I had expected in, you know, Wall Street Journal and other stuff. Now it's worth, I have validated, I've generated enough money to pay for the cost, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how you can kind of reason through, is a thing worth doing?
Yeah, 100%. And the book is rigging the game.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. It's your bestseller?
It is. Yep. Yep.
That is really, really cool. Kudos on that. I've dug into it a little bit, but I do want to ask you some questions. I know we've been hitting on some of the tools and the rules. What's your favorite that's in the book? As far as I know there's an arsenal in there. I know there's amazing nuggets. Is there one that you can drill down on, or is there so much interconnectedness that we have to touch on multiples, which, you know me, I'm definitely okay on that too.
Well, so I have the four commandments in there. I'm basically writing, I wrote it like a, what I call an operating system. So how would I try to execute on achieving financial certainty was what I was trying to kind of put together. And so it's set up as, here are these commandments. Why are they important? What happens to you if you violate them? And then there are these principles, or like algorithms of, like, okay, how do I actually execute on these commandments? And I have, within those 12 principles, they're divided into three categories. And one of them are these frames, like glasses that you can put on to have a different perspective. And because one of the core underpinnings of my philosophy is that we're all biased. And whether you know about the biases or not, you can know about ownership bias, but you're still subject to them. So just because you know doesn't mean you're not subject to them. There's actually a bias called G.I. Joe bias that says, even though you know, you're still, like, the more you know, it's not actually true that you won't be subject to it. Yeah. So we need to put on these glasses to try to give ourselves a chance at making the best decision, and also to recover from a bad decision. So it is unrealistic to expect that we will always make the right or best decision. But if we make a bad one, or one that's not serving us, can we recover sooner than we were in the past? And we just want to keep trying to shrink that window of time down. So maybe I used to get spun out for a week. Now I get spun out for 3 days. That's incrementally a huge change. Now if I can get it to 1 day and then get it down to 2 hours and then 30 minutes, each of those are significant when you compound it. So with that, one of those frames is called the investor frame. This is the one that people come back to me the most often to tell me is the most impactful, which is we go through typically once a quarter across all of the bets that we've made. Now, a bet in my world is anything that wasn't required in your business. So, and most of the time, most of our expenses are not required, believe it or not. Like, that extra employee you hired was a bet that you were going to grow the business. That marketing automation software was a bet that your marketing was going to become more efficient and you were going to have more sales. Like your business doesn't require it necessarily. Well, some businesses might. But if it's not core to your business, it's a bet. So most of us are professional gamblers. When you start to think about it, we just can't tell our family that because they'll want to, you know, have us checked into some sort of rehab. But we're all kind of gamblers in our own sort of way. And so we take all those bets and we go, what's the return? So oftentimes for a lot of these bets in our business, we don't have any data. So what's the return on hiring that employee? I have no data. So that's actually just a call to action to get some better data, better rules. But what is return? Based off what I know today, would I make this decision again? Is anytime you decide to continue an action, it's the equivalent of reinvesting in it. So based off what I know today, not what I knew when I made the decision, what I know today, would I buy this again? Would I invest in this again? Yes or no? Now, we've been taught if you're not a hell yes, you're a no. But I may, if you're not a hell yes, it's a counteroffer.
Nice.
Because so, that actually, a lot of times it still ends up as a no, but maybe the counteroffer gets you something you didn't think was possible. So if I say no, I wouldn't invest in this. Well, what would have to be true for me to change from a no to a yes? And how much time, energy, money, et cetera, all those different currencies, is it going to take for that to be true? So you put all that down and then you go, okay, is that something I'm willing to do? Yes or no? If you say yes, it is, then we're setting rules. When do I need to have the outcome by? What is the return I need to see? And so it's essentially, I'm not going to double down again on this if it doesn't meet the rules that I'm setting. If at any time you're like, yes, I would reinvest, or, yeah, then you just continue on. Right? But a lot of times you're going to say no. And if you say what would need to be true and you still say, no, I'm not willing to do that, that's an opportunity to recover all those resources and reallocate it to something that has much more asymmetric upside. So that's the investor frame. That's the one that I have people who, one guy came on his podcast, it's a student of mine too. He told me he set on his calendar once a week, a 30-minute investor frame, and it just goes off once a week and he goes back over the decisions he made over the last week and just reevaluates and decides if he wants to opt back in. I think Laura Portier, some of you maybe have heard her name. She's a fairly famous marketer and student of mine. She has a four lenses on a big whiteboard in her office that she, I don't know if she still does this, but she used to run every idea through it. And so the idea is just consistent frameworks to put yourself in the best position to make the right decision in the moment, but then readjust sooner to get back to an opportunity to make another asymmetric bet.
Yeah. I love how you know when you don't have enough data or you have zero data. I find there's a lot of people that think they have data, but it's not factual data. Mm-hmm. Is there a lens that takes that on or a rule that takes that on to decide if you have the facts? Have you done enough due diligence?
Yeah. So one of the criteria that I have is that it needs to be a preponderance of data, meaning it's overwhelming or it's clear, it's from more than one source. It's not based off hyperbole.
Yeah.
So this is one of my favorite words. So people will say the words objective or subjective. You know, subjective is based off me. Objective is, you know, separate or some independent kind of conclusion. But most of us make the decision that's phenomenological. It's just based off my experience. And that's dangerous insofar as it's like, well, you know, so much ego gets tied up and based on my experience. And so essentially, if you build up enough tolerance, which you will as an entrepreneur, then based off your experiences, well, I'm going to figure it out eventually. Right. So then that causes you to almost always follow what you want in the moment. Because based off my experience, I'll figure it out. That's not really data. That's just, I mean, it's data, but I don't think it's useful data to getting you to the outcome that you want.
Yeah, there's too many one-offs. And that's what I see. Like, yeah, people thinking that a one-off is a fact.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have to hone this other lens called the professional skeptic. And that's what CPAs were trained as, professional skeptics. But I'm looking at the data and I go, well, how do I know it's accurate? How do I know that, for example, say in April, our sales are way up. And I go, well, those Facebook, the marketing we're doing is really, really working. All right. So let's double down on Facebook ads. And because sales are up and we start running Facebook ads. And that's the end of it. We're good. And we looked at some of the return on ad spend, like, let's scale it out. But what we missed is that we went on this program with Steve and that I'm on right now. And actually what happened is a bunch of people heard that first and then they clicked on and they went to our website and then they started getting served the Facebook ads. And so then they bought. But actually what happened is they heard me on this program here and that's why they bought. And so a professional skeptic is like, well, how do we know we have all their, like, where did they really come from? When did they hear from us first? And so we make a lot of decisions based off looking at the data, but not actually getting to the metadata or the data about the data to figure out what is the real root cause.
Yes. Yeah. That's an awareness piece for sure.
Yeah, I think honing the assumption that you're wrong and asked and trying to, again, I believe that I'm biased and that, and I feel it. I go on Facebook and I feel that I'm jealous of other business owners sometimes. Right. And after that, I feel over the next 8 hours that I want to do something bigger. Right. And I'm not proud of that. I worked really hard on all of those things. Right. But which means I feel it more. I notice it more about myself than I did before, which is a win because I either recover from the decision faster or I don't do it to begin with. Right. But in the moment, am I making a decision because of the data or am I making a decision because of how I feel or how I want to feel in the next few minutes? I want that dopamine. And so my assumption is that I'm biased and therefore I need to check myself because it's probably some thing, some dopamine hit or reticular activating system thing that's going on. And so I assume I'm biased. Doesn't mean I'm not confident in myself and that I'm somehow passive. It's just that if what's the downside to that approach? If it turns out I wasn't biased, then I made an even better decision by checking myself and sort of logicking through it.
Yeah. Nice. What's the bandwidth look like as far as, because essentially when someone's onboarded, there's a certain amount of handholding or you're giving them the rules and the Bible, so to speak. What's that look like ongoing and what's the success stories look like around that? Cause I'm picturing to scale, you would need to have a massive team, but really if people understand the rules, they can maintain themselves quite a bit and just have to tap in when they have hard questions. Is that correct? Or
each person goes a little bit on their own journey about, and it depends on their receptivity to things. For some folks, it's drinking from a fire hose early on because realizing all these things they thought that they knew to be true, that they need to change and evolve. And Usually it's kind of a 12 to 18 month process of reorienting how you're thinking about stuff. But I have examples, case studies, someone who, for example, was they were operating a youth hockey league in California, and one of their goals was they wanted to buy some rinks in the Southern California area. And one of the challenges that they faced is it's going to be really cost intensive, but there's a risk for their business to not control the ice time because they're competing with other leagues and challenges of scheduling. And so the operating approach at the time was, I need to build up enough relationships with all these rink owners and then take out some loans to be able to buy into these rinks. And then the risk there is now you're in a totally different business, which is more of a retail business, potentially having to work weekends and people call out sick, operating this rink that's not just for your kind of youth hockey league. And so we sort of reasoned through, well, what are you really trying to accomplish? And how much of this do you really need to own? And let's think through the different currencies. So hockey is one of those things where I feel like there's no middle ground on hockey. You're either way into it or you're like, I know it exists. And not a lot of people that are in that kind of middle ground, at least the people I know that are into hockey are like into hockey.
Yeah.
And so it's an identity. It's an identity thing. Right. So in other words, there are wealthy people out there that want to be part of hockey and want to be able to say that they own these things as part of their identity. It doesn't necessarily have to be really profitable. So they were in ultimately able to do a deal, which I think they've done three or four of now, to buy up these hockey rinks with no capital, no personal capital. They still mostly control everything. But there are other people who wanted to say that they're part of owning these rinks as part of their kind of identity, but they don't want to run it. They don't really want to control it too much. So just thinking differently about effort and risk, we can get the same outcome that you want, way less effort, way less risk, by thinking about the different currencies.
Yeah. You know what I'm seeing as this interview unfolds and I get a glimpse inside of the Nth Degree, it feels like an incredibly integrous group, because it feels like people are coming to you because they want to have their taxes done. They want to have some problem solved. But what actually happens is that the consulting side takes over and you give them what they need. And they might not have even had, not even might not, they did not have an awareness of what they needed. They just knew what they wanted. And when those cross over, I see people just, you're serving people at an incredibly integrous level, because it does, it takes time and effort, and you had to create systems so that you could scale, or you run out of bandwidth because it's just one-on-one.
First off, I'm honored that you noticed that and said that. Our vision is actually doesn't say anything about accounting at all, is to help you live the life that you want. That's actually what I want to help, like, yes, help you live the life that you want, which means we have to help you figure out the life that you want, which is sort of that solvable problem. It just so happens that having better financial controls over your business and wealth and having these tools to make decisions allows you to, and recover taxes that you're paying, allows you to live the life that you want faster with less effort and less risk. But that's what I really care about. I happen to be good at the accounting and finance stuff, but really it's just a vehicle for me to help people live the life that they want.
Yes. And that's what we speak into the freedom. Like, you know, it started with my wife and I trying to figure out the freedom of it, but it doesn't matter how you look at it. If you're getting to the place, if you're getting to your destination, or if you're enjoying the journey, then, you know, how you look at that, it's amazing to have the kind of support that you have at the Nth Degree. Like I can just having this conversation, I can see it so clearly how much you care and how much time and effort that once again you put into the systems.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. This is really
nice. I think it's rare. And so it's you know, holding yourself, you talked about ownership. You know, you might be biased, but I can see what you've created is something that works. I'd like to hear a couple more success stories.
Sure.
Because I know you get those gut hits. There's some pretty big success stories, right? Whether they're, you know, 12 months in or 24 months in, that consistency that you spoke into earlier starts to pay dividends. And I'm making assumptions, but I want to hear the story if it's there.
Mm. So I can give lots of stories of situations where we've helped people exit their businesses for way more than they expected, or to recover taxes and things that we've come up with. Those are all like table stakes to me. It's sort of to be expected that's what we should be doing for clients as a CPA firm. They aren't table stakes for other firms who don't necessarily focus more on compliance, but I think that financial outcomes are sort of a to be expected. So the examples that tend to come to mind to me are about ways that people got clarity on what they really wanted in life and took a decisive action. For example, had a client who inherited their family business and came with a farm and also came with a bunch of debt. And they're trying to figure out how to navigate. We went through kind of the process of getting clear on their solvable problem. And they said, and we go through this exercise of what is your number one priority? Because the math says we want to allocate the overwhelming amount of resources to that top priority and try to lock that in first. And so we go through all of the exercise, and somewhere near the bottom was they want to move to California. They're living in the Midwest at the time. And finish all the analysis and what can be recovered and tax savings. Like, okay, if you do these things, you can pay off this farm in 2 months. And they said, great, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to move to California. That was what they actually wanted from their life. It's just that until they saw what was possible and knew that these obligations that they were carrying could be removed, that they were like, now had the clarity of what was really their number one, because you vote with your money. Yeah. I've had other client, another example, runs a pretty notable business in Montana. And 3 years ago, they were working 80 to 100 hour weeks. And it's in the kind of home services space. And just grinding away, a bunch of hours. We have this exercise where we talk about the rhythms, what I call the three rhythms. It's also in my book. Years ago, I learned about the rhythm. Microsoft is big on this thing called the rhythm of their business. It's essentially this idea that revenue and risks and things kind of happen in a predictable cycle, a predictable rhythm. And thinking about that, like, I think we need to be more specific. So I sort of expanded on that, and that there's three rhythms. There's a rhythm of your business. There's a rhythm of your industry. And then there's your personal rhythms. So rhythm of your industry is not something you can change in a short time horizon. Maybe not ever. Like, I can't change the fact that there's tax deadlines. I would like to. I don't love them. We got to have deadlines, but you know, busy season is tough. But there's a rhythm of the industry that we can't change. So the general thing is, let's not fight against rhythms we can't change. Seasonality, et cetera. So that's unchangeable. You can save a lot of money by not fighting against rhythms that you can't change. For example, I know of a lot of CPAs who spend a lot of money on marketing after April 15th because they want to run a different business. But they don't get any results during that because they're spending during a time when there aren't buyers active in the market. So they dig a bigger ditch, which then means they have to take on more tax returns. They're fighting against the rhythm. There's gyms who collect a bunch of money in January from New Year's resolutionists, and then they think that they've made it, and then they spend a bunch of money in subsequent months. But the industry rhythm is like January is going to be your biggest month. So we can't fight against those. But there's business rhythms, which are decisions you've made, collect ACH versus credit cards, what's your cancellation policies, all those sort of things that create risks and trade-offs. Those are changeable. Just have to be very cautious to think about the secondary and tertiary ramifications of that change. And then the third is personal rhythms. Like, I'm not allowed to do anything new in my business in January because it's when I'm the grumpiest. And I know that about myself. But there's also people who in certain areas in the South, for example, who are the most bloated in summer months because of allergies. And so it might lead to more irritations. And that's maybe something that you can change about yourself. When it's environmental, that's more challenging. But knowing that that's a personal rhythm, you have to be really aware of how that's going to impact your decision making. So back to my guy in Montana, he realized that he was fighting against some industry rhythms, some could change some business rhythms and some personal rhythms. And the outcome is that now he's fully out of running the day-to-day business. They've, I think, doubled in size. And he spent the entire month of February with his family in Kauai.
Nice.
It was, but it took him a year plus to map out and figure out all these rhythms and readjust instead of fighting against it. Acknowledging what can be changed and what can't be changed and how much our own personal rhythms impact things. So simplest takeaway, when you have a headache, you have a stomach ache, or you're grumpy, put it in your calendar, because there's a good chance that next year when you're feeling grumpy, have a headache or something, you can look and go, oh, I felt the same exact way or had the same thing happen. What is the cause of that? And just logging that down is like noted. I'm going to follow up on this next year. And what you might find is that it's the simplest thing to fix it, or it's not fixable. And you just need to restrict yourself from being irrational.
Yes. Yeah. Such good advice. Love that. All right. Hey, we're getting pretty close to time. I wanted to shine a light on not only where we can find you, I know I have people we're sending your way, and listeners and people that are watching, I'm assuming are going to want to find you. So where's the easiest spot to where we can do so?
Yeah, probably the easiest place is to go to my CPA firm's website, Nth Degree CPAs, just nthdegreecpas.com. I publish a bunch of just non-accounting stuff at unconventionalwealth.cash. So more of my thought leadership type stuff is there, newsletter, podcast, all that sort of stuff.
Perfect. You're also super generous with a gift. Can you unpack that a little bit?
So I have shared a bunch about the money rules document and solvable problem. And I just wanted to give away those worksheets that are usually just available to my clients.
Yes. So we'll make sure those are accessible on the link. Before we go, is there anything that you wanted to shine a light on? Because we don't know what we don't know. But if we missed anything, I'd love to get your insight, or something that you want to make sure that we have an acute awareness of.
So what I like to tell people, two things that are overarching the ways I live my life. One is that you can't solve a strategic problem with tactics. So it doesn't matter what the tactics are. If your strategy is wrong, might be a great tactic, but it isn't necessarily going to solve the overarching thing. And what is the strategy that I'm alluding to? It's that this last piece, which is the biggest risk in life is not living the life that you want. So the longer you put off getting clear and creating definition around what you want out of life, the longer you're taking the biggest possible risk. And that is a strategic problem. There's no tactics that can solve it.
Hmm. Yeah. Once again, incredible advice. And before we leave, I do want to point out how you've taken leadership qualities and leadership training and combined it into a strategic accounting and consulting package that I don't think it exists very many places. So I would really encourage people to take advantage of being able to use, I guess for lack of a better word, the mentorship that's available there.
Yeah. 100%. Well, what I would say is, one, you've been really generous today with your time and questions, and go to school on my tuition. So most of what I shared and have learned,
yes,
my own mistakes. So I don't speak from a position of like, I know it all and I've done this perfectly. Actually, I only know these things through my own mistakes. So go to school on my tuition. You don't have to pay full price.
I love how much alignment we actually have. I know you really haven't seen our program, but we speak into standing on the shoulders of giants so often. And, you know, for us and our kids, I want that to be us, because that's something that you just shouldn't have to start from zero. There is no reason. And on I see so many people on their financial journey, especially, you know, with us, with credit and raising capital, that they're just starting at zero every single generation. And it's something that, as far as, you know, last time we spoke, I'm a little bit of an efficiency freak. It's the least efficient thing there is for every generation to start at zero. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love the alignment. I really appreciate the work that you're doing and the access that you've given to us and to everybody just by existing and having the nth degree open. So, Dan, appreciate you. Really appreciate your time. We'll talk soon. All right, everybody. That's it for now. Take care, you guys.